We've had a very diverse range of talks. In fact, I was going to call my little intervention From Drumming to D Space, but then I realised that, of course, we've gone all the way back to the field right at the end, which I thought was very useful for me at least. And I don't really think that I can possibly summate or sum up such a diverse range of things. What I thought I would try and do, though, was be to pick out one of the two things that interested me and which I thought were important, and out of what I found extremely useful and stimulating and exciting discussion. And I have to say that if this is where WALP, as its acronym will be, World Oral Literature Programme, if this is where it's going, it's a very, very important initiative, I think, not only for this university, which has been a bit sleepy on such matters, but also for a much wider networks, and here we are in these networks. But I want to come back to say one or two things about what I think the other things that the programme might do. But anyhow, thank you all very much for such an exciting and stimulating day. I have learned more in one day than I had certainly hoped or expected I would. And also thank you, particularly Mark and Imogen, for organising this. I'm a bit of an imposter here in that most of my work is in Amazonia, whilst most of you come from or are experts in Asia and the Pacific, but I do have a minor Asian connection in that, apart from my work in northwest Amazonia, I have been involved in the cataloguing of the Young Husband collection. I've actually done research in Tibet and Bhutan on endangered culture. I won't go into how and why, but I am familiar with the problems of archiving material and de-space, as well as working with Amazonian Indians. My own work is very close to the kind of work that we've just heard Gerald Roche describing, that I too have been involved in a participatory work, particularly on shamanic chanting of the kind that we heard about this morning, and not only heard about, but actually heard. And my work is very much linked up with a project of education in a slightly different way from Gerald, in that what I'm doing is working with indigenous researchers who, by very good fortune, have been given the permission to run their... They kicked out the missionaries and they've been given the chance to run their own system of education using traditional knowledge as the basis, so that young researchers are researching their own oral traditions because this feeds into their educational system. The other thing, so that although most of my work is far away spatially, many of the issues that have been raised today are very, very similar indeed. I'm not going to go on talking about my own work, except to say that one of the problems was very neatly put by Yajung right at the beginning, where he said that the young are no longer interested in their traditions, and that is exactly something that I have... this is exactly what the fear of the elders with whom I work, and that's what they're trying to reverse through this educational program. Now, that thing is something which is, I think, global, that there is a global perception of cultural loss and global efforts. We see this all over the world, global efforts to preserve culture, and I think that is one of the... I'm going to skip forward a bit. Well, I think one of the things that the project, I hope, will bear in mind is that we need a certain amount of meta-reflection on what we're doing. I mean, we must... preserving, recording, archiving, analysing, disseminating oral literature is important, but I think it's also important to watch what we're doing and why we're doing it, because I think issues like culture, the very idea of cultural loss or indeed language loss it's frequently talked about, but it is far from transparent. The whole idea of culture as patrimony is not... It sounds self-evident because this is the discourse of native peoples, of UNESCO, etc., but there is a whole mass of problems therein, which I think as university researchers we can add to without displacing these more practical activities. So my work has been partly, my work has a practical component in that I've been trying to, and I think in a bit the way that Gerald Roche described, I've been trying over the course of the years to reduce my own importance. I started in the 60s as a young PhD researcher who never dreamt that one day the people on whom I was researching might actually be able to read my research and might actually be in a position to do their own research and call into question what I was doing. So that I've tried gradually to hand over my research to them and to take a back seat position where I can act as a stimulator and sometimes a friendly critic rather than directing the operations. But it's also that I've also at the same time keep on with my own academic research, partly because I find much the best way of doing it is actually this kind of participatory research. I think I've learned more in the last 10 years than the previous 30 years, simply because finally people are, they can see the point of why I want to know now, which they found harder in the past, and no longer do they say, as they have been doing recently in Colombia, investigación no, asesoría sí, which translates as no to research, but yes, we want your consultancy. In other words, we want your help. But now they say, asesoría sí, and you have to know what you're talking about so you can do research, because unless you know what you're talking about, you can't help us. So that the two chase each other's tails and feed into each other in that sense, but also because I have been interested in another theme, which I think, and again, this is the kind of meta-commentary that I think we need to be aware of, which is that there are some very interesting anthropological issues about why do people want to write things down? What are books for people? So that, for instance, one of the Tibetans I've been working with in Lhasa are extremely interested in digital cataloguing, in part because it's a powerful tool for cataloguing libraries in Tibet, which have been smashed by the Cultural Revolution. But it hasn't gone unnoticed to some of my Tibetan colleagues that hard disks are also very powerful prayer wheels, and that's a very different sort of take on digitization. And it hasn't gone unnoticed to my Amazonian colleagues that books are also ritual objects which can substitute for other ritual objects. So it's this kind of reflection about what lies behind or what can lie behind digitization or writing or making videos, etc. I've been very interested in the Kayapo, who are famous for making videos of each other and indeed wish to have themselves videoed making videos. That's part of the Kayapo political demonstration, is not just videoing, but making sure that the press video you in the context of videoing. So that, and the Kayapo say that the video camera is our new gun, and therein hangs a big tale. Now, I can't, I just want now to pick up, so that's what I mean by sort of meta-commentary about what are we doing. And I want to give, I'm slightly worried by our enchantment with digital technology, and I'll come back to that point in a minute. But just a couple of comments on that have come up, one of which has been, I think, a very interesting theme that's come up, which is really the theme which has run throughout this day, about the changing status of research and researchers. And that was clear, but we started up with Yajung, who's doing his own, thing. He's not here as the researched or as an informant. He is doing his own research. And we've been through, I found some of what David Nathan had to say about the new view of what archives are about and the way in which user communities and provider communities interface, extremely interesting. We have questions about what is at stake. And that, it seemed to me that when Ruth Finnegan very rightly asked the question, what are we trying to record? And I think Ruth, by and large, for very good reasons, had in mind her brilliant emphasis on the distinction between oral as in the sense of verbiage and oral in the sense of performance, which goes much, much wider was her theme. But I think there's also another theme which has come out of this conference, which is why are we trying to record this? And one of the reasons which has come out is very clearly that we have a commitment for ethical and political and various other reasons to the people who, if we are outside the searches, we have commitment to them. And that gives rise to a tension which I've seen throughout this day, and which again Gerald Roche mentioned right at the end, which is the status of archiving. What is the status of? There's a tension between archiving versus transmission. Are we trying to... It's not self-evident to me that archiving languages in D space or archiving narratives in D space will actually help the ongoing transmission and continued life. So I thought that this tension came out beautifully in the last two presentations were in the field in Vanuatu, in Qinghai, with local people doing their own research, very much related to the idea of stimulating people to get on and keep doing it, versus D-space. And I don't say that these are two places and technologies are contradiction, and the low-tech emphasis of Gerald Roche versus the very high-tech emphasis of Web 2, etc. I don't see these things as contradictory, but I do think we need to bear in mind that there's a very strong tension between keeping stuff, preserving it in aspic, or preserving it as a living tradition. And I thought I can't remember your first name, Michael, sorry. So, when we think about, when we hear about echo singing, and which is very much the sort of thing I see when people are chanting. When the people I work with in Amazonia go to chant, they say, let's go and learn. What they're doing is repeating in choruses, but their term for chanting is learning, because you learn through performance. And that means that there is a very, very big... Of course, we think that, you know, there's a hierarchy. We started in the bad old days. We started with dictation, notebooks, and all the rest of it. But then we got on to cassette tape recorders. Reel to reel, and then it was cassettes, and now it's mini discs, and now it's all video cameras. And we think we're getting closer and closer to truth and reality, and at least we can get the audio and the visual. Unfortunately, we haven't yet got the smellies and the feelies, but no doubt that will come later. But even if we bung all that stuff into D-space, we have still not actually got performance. And any of you who... Well, I'll give you two examples. The first one is that video of the wedding is nothing like the wedding that you attended. And the second point is that the video of the wedding actually comes to dominate the proceedings, so that somehow the tail starts wagging the dog. And that business of tail wagging the dog happens in the field also. My other example is right at this moment, if you go across the road, you will see the BBC recording the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols, which will go out on Christmas Eve. But of course it didn't actually, it wasn't recorded on Christmas Eve at all, it's been recorded today. Why? Because King's College got so fed up with the fact that the recording tail began to wag the carol's dog, that they have bracketed off the recordings, and now so they get on with the real thing on Christmas Eve without the telly cameras there. So that I think we must be very, very careful about confusing audio-visual capture with the actual business of performance itself. Alan McFarlane made a very interesting comment, which I would like to pick up and take further, which was he remarked that there was a kind of unhappy coincidence that Führer Heimendorf, at the very moment that Führer Heimendorf was able to record dying traditions, that was the beginning of the development of those these recording devices. But I don't think it's just a coincidence. I think the two are actually causally linked, so that I think that there are some very, very real dangers about our entrancement with D digital technology. I have, where I work with in Amazonia, there are four, the most of the young, it's the younger school educated school teachers who keep saying, we are losing our traditions, they must do them, we are going to record them. So there are plenty of people queuing up to learn how to use digital cameras and audio-visual recording devices, but there are very few people queuing up to actually do the performances that the others want to record. So that instead of more a lot of chiefs and no Indians, you're going to get a lot of video cameras and no performance. And I think that I could go extend this point, but I think the whole issue of digital divide is very dangerous, because if the Indians that I am working with in Amazonia are very keen to archive their stuff, they keep telling me, and I've actually been working on an archival project. But if there's a problem of where is this going to be archived, because if it's archived here, and if these people need to acquire web information technology in order to access their culture, that culture, the very procedures which will allow them to do that are the very procedures which will exterminate the tradition that I'm in, and they are interested in conserving. So that I think that we need to be careful, and I think we need to think very carefully about high-tech versus low-tech solutions. And I thought again what Gerald Rush was saying was extremely interesting. I could go on about fixity and change, which was another theme about, and the issues of authenticity. Just quickly to say that we had Lisson Bolton talking about the fact that in Vanuatu you can actually sell languages and you can sell rituals, you can sell custom. There are some very, very important differences in different societies between, and I think this was a point that Ruth Finnegan mentioned. I usually use the distinction between jazz music and classical music. Where I work is in Amazonia, you play Beethoven. In other words, shamanic chanting, if we can call it shamanic chanting, is about exact repetition, and people are schooled and drilled and drilled and drilled and drilled and drilled and drilled until they get it absolutely word perfect. So they play Beethoven. You get brownie points for a good performance, but you mustn't alter the words. Next door, they play jazz. You have to play it, you have to play in a recognizable, or chant in a recognizable genre, and you have to be a good chanter, but you get the emphasis is upon improvisation. And of course, we see even in Western music, if we go back 200 years, improvisation was much, much more important than it was today. So that there is a tension there. I think we need to be very careful when we talk about cultural preservation and cultural loss and who owns what. We have to specify it in very differing cultural traditions about whether you borrow things. Indeed, in a lot of Amazonia, the characteristic pattern is that the best songs are actually captured in warfare. The best stories are captured in warfare. The best ritual ornaments are captured. In other words, that things which are ours, which if they're going to be powerful, they must come from outside. Whereas where I work, they must come from the ancestors, etc. I could go on. There have been the other thing which has come up, which I thought was extremely interesting, and I thought Judy Pettigrew, in particular, from one end, and our two speakers this afternoon on technical matters raised, is that there's a whole mass of technical, political, practical, ethical, etc., 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 issues and problems. And I thought that Peter Austin's point that actually this has been much discussed, there are already networks to discuss this, was a very important point, but I thought it was very interesting that these problems were raised here. And I think that's another thing that the programme can and should do. One last point, which is, finally, I think we need to ask the question, is forgetting really so awful as we think it is? There is, not only in our world of obsessed with recording everything, and I know Alan and I disagree about this, I'm a chucker out, and my wife and Alan are hoarders. They keep everything, and I chuck it all out. I move forwards in time. I work with... I work with people who are also chuckers out, but believe that they're standing still. In other words, they think that things have, or they talk as if things were founded at the beginning of mythological ancestral time and have never changed, and yet they change very rapidly. They in fact, so rapidly that they pun their language so that when groups of people have been away for 3 months, they come back and the others can hardly understand what they're talking about. So there's very rapid change, and yet they believe that nothing changes at all. So I don't think that forgetting is so awful, and I think that, I think that forgetting is the motor of a lot of what we call oral literature and oral societies. And I thought Erin's point she had on one of her PowerPoints, do we keep everything forever, was a very, I think, therein is something that we could reflect on much more than we have, and which relates to these whole issues about endangered languages, archives, etc. That's not to say that I don't think what we're doing is important, but I think that we need to be careful. There's that lovely story about the king who wanted better and better and better maps, and the maps were going to be, you know, every detail was in, and finally they had a map which fitted the country perfectly and snuffed out all the inhabitants. And I think that we might get snuffed out by too much memory. So, thank you.